Hi, and welcome to Guidepost. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading from the October-November 2025 issue of Guidepost magazine with articles like Taken for Granted. Making Marriage Work. Taken for Granted. I Wondered If My Husband Even Realized How Much I Did For Us by Diane Stark, Brazil, Indiana. My husband, Eric, was driving us to his mom's birthday party just across town. By the way, the shipping was delayed on your mom's present, I said, so we don't have anything else to give her today. I was about to add that I should have gotten a card for us to write that her present was on the way, but stopped when I saw Eric's mouth drop. We don't, he said sharply. No, we don't, I snapped, because the present I ordered, well ahead of time, I might add, hasn't arrived yet. Eric didn't say a word. That's because he knows I'm right, I thought. I adore my mother-in-law, and I was happy to handle getting her a gift, but why did my husband just assume that I would take care of it? And this was for his mom. Why didn't Eric give her birthday present a single thought until we were on her way to her party? Maybe because he had gotten used to me handling everything that kept our household running. After all, I bought all the gifts, Easter, Christmas, birthday for our five kids, Eric's mom, basically everyone but myself. I maintained our family calendar and knew exactly where we had to be and when. I kept track of the kids' activities and knew when it was our turn to bring the meal for our life group at church. The grocery list, cooking, laundry, all my responsibility for years. Without me, the fridge would be empty. No one would have clean clothes to wear. And there wouldn't be any toilet paper. I didn't always feel this way. For the first 12 years of our marriage, Eric had run a business with 90 employees while I'd been a stay-at-home mom. His job was demanding, and he worked hard to support our family. It made sense for me to run the household then. But now I was working too, and our household responsibilities hadn't changed much. These days, Eric ran a new, smaller business and didn't have to put in the hours he used to. Recently, I'd asked him to help out more around the house. He took over washing and drying clothes, leaving the clean laundry for me to fold and put away. I didn't mind folding clothes, so that was fine with me, or at least it had been until I heard him telling our friends proudly, "I take care of the laundry now." Eric was doing half the job, but he was acting as if he did all of it, as if he deserved a trophy for helping me with what should have been joint tasks. I put so much time into everything I did for our family, and it felt as if all my effort was simply invisible to him. And now he had the nerve to be upset that we didn't have his mom's birthday present. I'd never felt so unappreciated. Lord, I prayed, help Eric see everything I do for this family. I was still feeling kind of resentful on the way to our next family gathering, this time for Thanksgiving at my brother's house. For most of the three-hour drive, I stayed quiet, letting Eric and the kids talk while I thought about what I wanted to get them on Black Friday. Every year, my sister-in-law and I hit the sales together, and I would get the bulk of our family Christmas shopping done. It was yet another task I took care of, though one I really enjoyed. The deals allowed me to stretch our budget and get much nicer Christmas gifts for our kids than we could offer otherwise afford. After dinner, while the guys and the kids were watching football, my sister-in-law and I got down to planning. We sat at the kitchen table, the newspaper ads spread out in front of us, making lists of what we wanted to buy and plotting our route for the next morning. Eric poked his head into the kitchen. Bad news, he said. I got a text alert from the credit card company about a suspicious charge in another state. I had to cancel the card. Thanks for the heads up, I said. It's not a big deal. I'll just use our debit card for my Christmas shopping tomorrow. What are you planning to buy? Eric asked. When I showed him my list, he shook his head. We just paid college tuition. What's left in the checking account won't cover all this. You mean I can't go Black Friday shopping? I asked. But I look forward to this all year. Sorry, honey, Eric said. I know you're bummed, but there's nothing we can do. He paused. I'm going to run to the gas station and fill up the car for our trip home. I've got enough cash for that. I sank back in my chair and sighed. I do so much for the family, and now I can't even have a little fun. An hour later, Eric came back wearing a big smile and carrying a coffee cup with a gas station logo on it. You got coffee at the gas station? I asked. When I saw how upset you were, I dug through my wallet and found another credit card, Eric said. It expired, but I knew our account was still open. After I filled up the card, I called the credit card company and explained what happened and how you had a big shopping trip planned. Person I talked to adjusted something in the system to allow the car to work. And I know it does because I used it to buy your coffee. He set the cup in front of me. "No way," I said, jumping up and throwing my arms around him. "I can't believe it. I would never even think to do that." As a matter of fact, during our entire 18 years of marriage, I'd never paid a single credit card bill or any bill at all. We've lived frugally, raising our 5 kids, making clipping coupons, and shopping end of season sales a must. But I'd never had to worry about our family finances. I simply bought what we needed with our credit card, knowing that when the bills came, Eric would take care of them. Come to think of it, I never had to worry about mowing the lawn, raking leaves, or shoveling snow either. My husband did it all. He cleaned the garage, vacuumed the house, and always kept my car maintained. Broken appliances? Not for long. They were all fixed by Eric. It struck me that all the tasks I took care of weren't invisible to him. It was just that he was juggling as much as I was, and he did it without complaining or feeling resentful or keeping score, which was more than I could say for myself. "Forgive me, Lord, for praying the wrong prayer," I thought. "I should have asked you to help me appreciate all Eric does for us, and for us never to take each other for granted." Before I could tell Eric how I felt, he stepped back from our hug and took my hands. "I'm sorry I snapped at you about my mom's birthday gift," he said. "I should have helped with that." "I'm sorry I snapped too," I said. "You do more than I ever realized, and I am so grateful." "We make a great team, don't we?" he asked. "Are you kidding me?" I said. "The best." I was excited about my son, my only child, going off to college. I also knew it was taking him away from me. But the one thing we would always keep us connected, Thanksgiving Masala, by Cynthia Gandhi Dobbs, Tulsa, Oklahoma. "Ah, I just love that smell," my 18-year-old son Obadiah said, standing at the stove, searing the chicken we'd marinated for our famous Thanksgiving dish, tikka masala. Hints of ginger, garlic, and Indian spices wafted in the air. Tikka masala might be a bit unusual for an American holiday meal, but in our multicultural family, it was the centerpiece. "I thought I had this down," he said, "but I'm still not sure how to get all this yogurt off before frying." I grabbed a toothpick and said, "Let me show you again." I pierced a cube of chicken with my left hand, scraped off the extra marinade using my gloved right hand, and returned it to the pan. "You make it look easy, Amma," Obadiah said with a smile that reached his warm, intelligent brown eyes. Eyes that I'd loved looking into since they first blinked up at me when he was born. Now that baby face was slightly stubbled, the face of a young man who would soon be leaving home for college. Trying to keep my tone casual, I said, "After a while, you just get used to it. Just as you'll get used to this season of lasts," I told myself. This was our last Thanksgiving before Obadiah headed to Oklahoma State. I was excited for him, my only child, to embark on this new adventure. I knew he was ready, yet I couldn't help but wonder if we would have time together like this in the kitchen again, with no hurry, no need to check our calendars, just Obadiah walking out of his room and asking, "Amma, want me to be your sous chef today?" Would he be too busy with college friends, engrossed in his classes, occupied with new activities? It wouldn't be the first time I'd had to let my son go. Obadiah was born extremely premature. He was tiny, only 1 pound, 9 ounces, and given just a 50-50 chance of survival. I wanted to hold him close to protect him from anything that could hurt him, but the NICU nurses took him away from my arms and placed him in an incubator so that little by little he could heal and grow. The uncertainty of his future had me on my knees in prayer often. I learned begrudgingly to let my son go, to trust that God and the NICU team would help him not only survive, but thrive. And boy, did he. By the time Obadiah was 2, we stumbled onto routines that became treasured rituals. Cooking was one of them. I could still picture him as a toddler, perched in his high chair a safe distance from the stove, wide-eyed with wonder. Then the question started, "Why is that sauce orange? Where did those things you cook come from?" He was so curious, hungry to know more. I marveled at the places his mind traveled to. After he started school, the kitchen became even more a place of learning. He'd sit at the table doing homework, occasionally asking for help. He wanted to know about the dishes my mother used to make for me. She passed away when I was 12, so he'd never gotten to meet her. I made the same dishes for him as a way of sharing our family history. As Obadiah grew, his questions evolved. They were no longer just about food, but delved into science and school, relationships, and the realities of growing up. For the two of us, the kitchen became our sanctuary, were making dinner served as an excuse to catch up on our days and talk about everything, and sometimes nothing at all. Over the years, he'd become my trusted sous chef. He picked up on my tips and tricks, knew my rhythm in the kitchen, and never missed a beat. One of my favorite recipes, tikka masala, became his favorite too. The day before, when we'd made the marinade, Obadiah had known where I kept every spice. Not an easy feat in a kitchen as stocked with spices as ours. Part of me wanted to hold on to every moment we spent here together. Now the kitchen was alive with motion, reminding me that I couldn't freeze time. We chopped onions and cilantro for the biryani rice, a rice dish that sauteed in the Instapot. After he'd gotten plain rice going in the cooker, Obadiah had turned to the kitchen's chicken, searing each piece on all sides. "Okay, the chicken's done," he said. We set it aside and poured the leftover marinade into the pan. We lowered the heat to let the sauce reduce. "Now the tomato sauce?" Obadiah asked. I nodded, and we added it to the pan, followed by heavy cream. Obadiah stirred, watching as the colors blended into a rich red-orange. The tikka sauce bubbled, sending sputters onto his hand. He didn't flinch. He adjusted the heat calmly, confidently. He looked so grown. "You're wearing it," I teased, handing him a towel. He grinned, wiping his hands. Occupational hazard for the sous chef. Once the sauce thickened, we returned the chicken to the pan. The rice cooker beeped. Obadiah warmed the naan, a soft flatbread, while I pulled out our copper serving dishes. The Instapot let out its final beep, signaling the biryani was ready. I scooped it into a serving bowl, garnished it with cilantro. We combined chopped cucumber, tomato, and onions with yogurt in a bowl to make a raita. It was nearly time for our friends to arrive, most of them college students who wouldn't make it home for the holiday. My husband and I had gotten to know them working in campus ministry here in Tulsa. My son and I moved in sync, me getting each dish ready for the presentation, Obadiah carrying it to the table. The tikka masala went in the center. Obadiah set the naan beside it, stacked like fluffy blankets. Then he arranged the biryani, white rice, and raita. We had made Thanksgiving dinner together one more time. Our dining room filled with friends who brought laughter, warmth, and bottomless appetites, as only college students can. I caught a glimpse of Obadiah, his shirt dotted with tiny splashes of tikka sauce, just like mine. His face was lit with joy. It was as if God was giving me a glimpse of my son's future, where he'd be surrounded by new friends at Oklahoma State, having the time of his life. In that moment, a quiet contentment settled over me. No matter where Obadiah goes or who he's with, our kitchen rituals and family recipes will connect us, just as our faith does. For more on this story, see Family Room. Cynthia's Chicken Tikka Masala. 2 to 2.5 pounds boneless chicken breasts or thighs cut into bite-sized cubes. 2 tablespoons ginger garlic paste. 1 teaspoon turmeric. See tip 1. 1 tablespoon garam masala. 1 tablespoon cumin. 1 teaspoon chili powder or more to taste. 1/2 cup plain yogurt or dai. 2 tablespoons ghee or olive oil or vegetable oil. 1 32-ounce can of tomato sauce. 1.5 cups heavy cream. Cilantro for garnish, optional. Make marinade. Place chicken, ginger garlic paste, spices, and yogurt or dai in a resealable bag. Massage until ingredients are mixed and chicken is fully coated. Marinade for 30 minutes on the counter or up to overnight in refrigerator. See tip 2. Cook tikka. Set a pan over medium heat. When pan is hot, add ghee or oil. Add chicken to pan, retaining as much marinade as you can in the bag. Turn each piece every so often until it is seared on all sides and fully cooked. Monitor heat carefully. If too hot, the oil and spices will spatter or burn. Remove chicken from pan. Make masala. Add marinade to pan. Reduce over medium heat until it's a consistency of a roux. Add tomato sauce and cream. Stir to combine. Simmer over low heat until sauce thickens. Return chicken to pan. Simmer for 5 to 10 minutes until sauce comes together with chicken. Garnish with cilantro if desired. Serve with rice and or naan. Serves 8. tips. Number one, turmeric stains fabric. I recommend OxyClean Max Horse Gel to remove the stain. Two, you can freeze batches of the marinated chicken and thaw it when you're ready to use it. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guideposts magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guideposts' other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. Caregivers, lessons from Elaine. What this ex-governor learned about caregiving after his wife of 47 years was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, by Marty Schreiber, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was love at first sight. From the moment we met in Latin class our freshman year at Lutheran High School in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the fall of 1953, I knew I wanted to marry Elaine Ruth Thawney and spend the rest of my life with her. Elaine was an A student, cheerleader, and member of the synchronized swimming team. She even took up the drums. She later told me she did it so she could be in the school band with me. We dated through high school and college and married in 1961. Elaine planned to become a teacher, but put her studies on hold so she could work to support us while I went to law school. She was my biggest champion during my years as a state senator, then lieutenant governor. Elaine went back to college in the mid-1970s and finished her education degree. In 1977, I became the 39th governor of Wisconsin. She managed my schedule, raised our four children, hosted dinner parties, and welcomed championship sports teams and dignitaries such as Lillian Carter to the executive residence. Somehow, Elaine made it all look effortless. When I lost the next election and transitioned from politics to running my own government relations firm, she never let me feel defeated. I always say if it weren't for her, there wouldn't be me. Having married so young, we were empty nesters by our early 50s. She took care of me as I recovered from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, sailed with me from Florida to New York, and together we volunteered for organizations around town. Such good times. We thought they would last forever. But in her mid-60s, the first signs came that something was wrong. Elaine got lost on her way home from the grocery store and left our key ingredients in dishes she'd cooked for years. Her interest in long-held hobbies withered. In 2007, the diagnosis came, Alzheimer's. Eventually, she forgot the people she loved most, her friends, our children, our grandchildren, and even me. Is there anything more heartbreaking than watching a loved one lose their memories, lose what makes them who they are? Elaine battled Alzheimer's for 18 years before she passed away in 2022. This ugly disease stole the future we should have had together. It was like death by a thousand cuts. Yet through our journey with Alzheimer's, Elaine taught me that those cuts can heal, that there is hope. Here are some lessons I learned along the way that I wish I'd known sooner. I hope they help you too. Grieve for who they were, but embrace who they are. At first, I tried desperately to hold on to who Elaine was, upbeat, gracious, and organized. As the Alzheimer's took over, she became unpredictable. Elaine with Alzheimer's could be sweet or argumentative, kind or agitated. Worst of all, as the disease progressed, she had no recollection of me, our children, or our grandkids. I felt like a widower who still had a wife. To cope, I decided to think of Elaine as two people. My first Elaine, before Alzheimer's, my second Elaine, after Alzheimer's, my two Elaines. That allowed me to embrace one of my second Elaine's greatest qualities, being in the moment. Her doctor recommended walking, the best exercise for the brain. One day we set out on the path behind our condo. My goal was to finish in 30 minutes and go on with our day, but Elaine kept stopping. "Do you hear the birds singing?" she asked. "Look at that butterfly." This Elaine didn't have an agenda to stick to. She was right there in the now, seeing God's blessings all around us. I discovered that even though she didn't recognize me or our children, talking to her about us was still important. She could feel the joy in these people she was hearing about, as if they were characters in a good story. When I let go of my first Elaine and embraced my second Elaine, we were both much happier. Join their world. You cannot argue with Alzheimer's and expect to win. Trying to keep a lane in my world that didn't happen on Thursday, it happened on Friday, only made her more confused and distressed. Elaine once asked about her parents, and I made the mistake of reminding her that they had passed away long ago. This came as news to her, and she was distraught. Did we take good care of them, she asked? Did I go to their funerals? Until I saw her stricken expression, I didn't understand that the facts weren't always relevant. I had to learn to choose comfort over correction. Joining her loved one's world can lead to a sweet moments, too, where you can't help but notice God's grace. Like the time Elaine and I were having lunch and she began to cry. Whenever I asked her why, she said, I'm starting to love you more than I love my husband. I didn't try to correct her by saying, but I am your husband. I simply accepted her heartfelt statement. In its own way, this was a moment of joy, of falling in love again. The details are not important. Only the bigger picture matters, supporting and loving your person. You can't pour from an empty cup. Asking for help does not mean you're weak. You'd think I would know that. I'd spent years in politics and business, delegating responsibility to my staff. But I thought that if I loved Elaine, if I prayed for strength, that somehow I could handle caregiving on my own. Our friends and our children offered to lend a hand and regularly visited with Elaine, but I didn't want them catering to me. Like many caregivers, I put myself last. Regular exercise, healthy meals, socializing, how could I squeeze any of that into a day filled with doctor's appointments, household chores, and job duties? I skipped workouts and quit seeing our friends. Over the span of a year and a half, I gained 20 pounds and developed high blood pressure. Did that get me to change my habits? No. Stubborn. That's me. 3 years after Elaine's diagnosis, one of the nurses at her neurologist's office sat me down. Have you joined any support group? She asked. Me? I asked, puzzled. I'm from that generation of men who aren't supposed to have feelings, much less talk about them. The nurse reminded me that chronic stress experienced by Alzheimer's caregivers can shorten their lives by 4 to 8 years. That set me straight. I reached out to the Alzheimer's Association. Staff there linked me to a counselor who put me in contact with other family caregivers. We turned to each other for advice and checked in to make sure we were eating right, exercising, and staying social. What a difference that made in my well-being. After Elaine's, taking care of yourself enables you to take better care of your loved one. I wish I had done it sooner. Don't be stubborn like me. Reach out to the Alzheimer's Association, your friends, faith community, and family. Call or text. Be specific. Can someone buy a few groceries, walk the dog, bring meals? Caregiver burnout and loneliness feed on each other. First, admit you need help, then get it. Let go of guilt. At times I wondered, does feeling overwhelmed or irritable make me a bad caregiver? Not at all. Those feelings are normal. Every setback, big or small, gets magnified when you're a caregiver. I call it irrational irritability. I learned that when I took Elaine to our Florida condo to escape the Wisconsin winter, I brought some cash to cover meals and expenses, putting it in a jar on the dresser. The next day it was gone. I searched everywhere, frantic and furious. Elaine, where is that money? I demanded. She couldn't tell me. Thankfully, 4 days later, I found the cash stuffed in a sock in the dresser. I realized that tucking away the money was Elaine's way of helping me keep it safe. I was frustrated at myself for snapping at her. Forgive yourself. Get angry at the disease rather than your loved one. Home isn't always best. One of the hardest things is admitting that your home may not be the safest place for your loved one. Even after praying about it, I said to my counselor, I just can't see putting Elaine in a nursing home. When the time comes, she said, you're not putting her anyplace. You cannot respond to all her needs. A dementia care unit can. Can Marty Shriver's 24-hour nursing home take the best care of Elaine? The answer was a resounding no. That made it easier for me to accept that once her Alzheimer's progressed, Elaine was much better off in a skilled memory care facility. She moved to a facility just a couple miles from where we met, then lived there her last 7 years. I visited her every chance I got. The memory care team took great care of her, far beyond what I could have done at home. I'm thankful that I didn't let my pride keep me from the ultimate goal for both of us to live our best possible lives. I carry these lessons from my two Elaines with me to this day. Despite the challenges of our journey, boy, do I feel blessed that I met Elaine Ruth Thaney freshman year in Latin class. Blessed to fall for her, blessed that she supported every dream I had, blessed we raised such wonderful kids, blessed I got to hold her hand every day until the end. Alzheimer's could never take away that love away. For more on this story, see Family Room. Answered prayers. Thank you, Lord, for the home health aids in my mother's life. Please continue her restoration and renewal. Yvette. My fiancé and I met as children and got together now as adults, 40 years later. An answer after years of praying. Lisa. God sent me a grocery gift card and fixed my sink. It was not an emergency, but he did so anyway. Praise his name. Barbara. I finally had a breakthrough in my depression. Through prayers and finding the right doctor, I feel human and energized again. It took a long time, but God led me through it. There is hope. Kathy. From our readers and website visitors, send your answered prayers to submissions@guideposts.org. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.